Once upon a time, in the city of Susa, which was the capital city of the Persian Empire, the cupbearer to the king was going about his normal daily duties. Now, this cupbearer to the king is kind of a strange term for us, but a cupbearer to the king was the guy that the king trusted more than anybody else in the entire empire. This particular cupbearer was a Jew named Nehemiah. The king and Nehemiah had a really good friendship. But that day, Nehemiah, as he went about his duties, the king noticed that there was kind of a sadness upon Nehemiah, like he was carrying some kind of heavy burden. And so he asked Nehemiah, "What's the matter?" And Nehemiah told him all about his native city, Jerusalem, that lay in ruins. He told him about the temple to his God that was completely destroyed. And he told the king how heavy of a burden he felt for his native city. Now the king listened thoughtfully, and then he did the unthinkable. He said, "Nehemiah, I think you should go back to Jerusalem. I think you should rebuild those walls. I think you should rebuild your temple. And I think you should take the Jews with you. And I free you guys to go back to your city and to rebuild Jerusalem." Well, the mass caravan left Susa soon after en route to Jerusalem. It was Nehemiah plus 50,000 Jews. Imagine how long that caravan was. They were making their way along on their way on the road to Jerusalem. Now, what's really interesting about that story is that just 70 years before, all those people were taken into captivity by a guy named Nebuchadnezzar. Now, that's interesting enough, but what is even more interesting is that 100 years before the battle, 100 years before King Nebuchadnezzar came and he took those Judites into captivity, 100 years before that all happened, Jeremiah the prophet made this prediction. "For thus says the Lord, when 70 years are complete for Babylon, I will visit you, and I will fulfill to you my promise and bring you back to this place." Exactly 70 years later, the big caravan leaves Susa on its way to Jerusalem, exactly how the Lord said it would happen. So when Nehemiah arrived in the land, he had to scope out and decide what needed to be done. But you can imagine how tall of an order it was for him. He was the governor. He was the one in charge. But how do you settle 50,000 people? How do you decide who gets what land? How do you decide new laws? And what do you do with those that have been squatting on the land for all of these years? How do you make all of this happen? So Nehemiah had a pretty big chore ahead of him. Of course, he had to figure out food. He had to figure out laws and new laws. He had to figure out who got what allocation of land according to their ancestry. So there was a lot of work that he had to do. And of course, a lot of properties were left unclaimed. And what do you do with those? But Nehemiah persevered, and soon his perseverance paid off, because soon the walls were rebuilt around Jerusalem. And pretty soon after that, the temple was rebuilt. And in 516 BC, it was the very first time that worship was reestablished in the land of Judah. And on that day that the temple was rededicated, we read that some of the oldest among them that still remembered the previous temple, on the dedication day, a lot of those old elders among them, they wept before the temple. And they cried because of the years lost to sin. They cried because they remembered the former splendor of Solomon's great temple. And they cried for the joy of reestablishing worship. Meanwhile, back in Susa, the new king needed a queen. And little did he know it at the time, but he chose a young Jewish girl named Esther to be his new queen. Well, we want to start, as we have over these last several Sundays, with our map. So let's put the map up there, Abby. And if you remember, if you haven't been here, you'll be a little bit lost, but we'll try to catch you up. My Bible here is the Sea of Galilee. This black book is the Dead Sea. The Jordan River runs between the two. And here on the map, we have Over on this side, over to the west, we have Egypt, over where Matt is and Norm is over there. And over here, we have Babylon over with this crew over here. This is our map. And remember, everything that we find in the Old Testament happens somewhere on this map. Now, we've walked through all of this, all of the stories of the Old Testament over the last several weeks. I want to pick up the part of the story where we begin with the kings. Because today we're going to be looking at the historical books. And the historical books of the Bible span 1,000 years. So I'm going to try to take 1,000 years, put it together in one sermon that doesn't feel like it goes on for 1,000 years. I'll try my best. All right? So let's pick up the story with the three kings. And remember, we're going to talk back and forth. So there were three kings that ruled over all the land. What was the name of the first king? Saul. What was the name of the second king? David. What was the name of the third king? Solomon. Now, what's interesting about the story I just told you is that it was Solomon that actually built the first temple in Jerusalem. His father David wanted to, but the Lord told him, because you are a man of blood, because you have killed so many people in battle, you're not the one to rebuild, to build the temple for me. Your son Solomon is the one that's going to do it. Now, what a lot of us don't know about that story is that David had a whole lot of years and really deep pockets to get things ready for his son. So he commissioned for furniture and gold vessels and even the blocks to go around the temple. He commissioned all of that to be done. So when Solomon took over and it was time to build the temple, a lot of the work had already been done. David had the vision for this temple of the Lord. So there were three kings that ruled over all of Israel. When Solomon dies, the kingdom is divided. Remember, I told you the story of his son Rehoboam. Rehoboam had the chance to save the whole kingdom. And he listened to his dad's advisors who said, hey, lower taxes. Then he listened to his friends who said, no, raise taxes. And he decided to go with his friends and he raised taxes and the kingdom was divided over the issue. Now, as the kingdom is divided, there were 10 tribes that went north and they formed a nation called Israel, and 2 nations went south and they formed a nation called Judah. What was the capital city in the north? Samaria. Capital city in the south? Jerusalem, right. So that's all part of these stories of the historical books. Now, after the kingdom is divided and the nations begin and there's battles between them, there's lots of good and bad. But remember, we talked about the 10 northern tribes, this nation of Israel. They had 0 good kings. Not a single one who turned the people to the Lord. So the Lord could only put up with that for so long. And after about 250 years after the death of Solomon, 250 years later, a guy named King Shalmaneser, who came from Assyria, which was up here in this neck of the woods, you can see it up on the map, Assyria. I was looking over there, Assyria, that's something different. I'm suddenly hungry, you know. So Assyria, the capital city is Nineveh. King Shalmaneser, he comes down into Israel, and he takes into captivity the 10 northern tribes, takes them into captivity, and they're never heard from again in the Bible because the Lord could not stand the wickedness in his own people. 586, a guy named King, do you guys remember the name? King Nebuchadnezzar. Everybody say Nebuchadnezzar. You guys are a little quiet this morning. It's a little warm in here. Anybody else warm? Should open up the windows. Anyway, King Nebuchadnezzar. King Nebuchadnezzar from Babylon, 586. He brings his army. He conquers everybody. Gets all the way over here to Judah. Conquers Judah. This is Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. This is Daniel, the guys, and many of the princes. They're all taken into captivity. Now, the story I just told you about Jeremiah happened 70 years later. Remember, the Lord brings them into captivity for 70 years. And after 70 years, exactly like Isaiah and Jeremiah predicted, exactly 70 years to the year, Nehemiah, the cupbearer, leads his people out with Ezra and Zerubbabel, the commander. They come back into the southern tribes, the southern part of the nation, Judah. They rebuild the walls. They rebuild the temple. They reestablish worship. And that is how the Old Testament ends. So, that's the last week that we're going to do a partial. From this point on, we're going to do the whole thing every week, and we're going to try to work on that a little bit together. So the Old Testament is what we were talking about. If you haven't been with us the last few weeks, we've been trying to walk through the Old Testament and kind of remember these stories. Remember what we love about the Old Testament. Remember all of these great teachings and the wisdom. And so last week I talked about what is called the Pentateuch. The Pentateuch is the first five books of the Old Testament. So it's Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. That's called the Pentateuch, the books of Moses, sometimes called the book of the law, sometimes called the book of the covenant. The Pentateuch, first five books. We talked about the Shema. Hear, O Israel, the Lord is one. And the importance of the Shema to the centrality of all that is part of Judaism as a religion. That was last week. So today we're turning towards the history books. Joshua all the way through Esther. Joshua, Judges, 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings, 1 and 2 Chronicles, Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther. 12 books, right? Now remember, for us, these are 12 books. In the Hebrew Bible, 1 and 2 Samuel is one book. 1 and 2 Kings, one book. 1 and 2 Chronicles, one book. Ezra, Nehemiah, one book. But for us, these are 12 books. Now, in these 1,000 years then, there's all kinds of things that happen. There's a conquering, and that happens, if you remember the story, when after Moses dies over here, he climbs Mount Pisgah, and Joshua and Caleb take the people into the promised land. But the first thing that happens is they have to conquer Canaan. Cana is filled with the Hittites and the Perizzites and the Gerishites, and they had to conquer all of these people. So the beginning of the 1,000 years of history in the history book begins with conquest. Then we have the time of the judges. Then we have the rise of the monarchy, that whole three kings ruled over all of Israel. Remember, that was the great time when the people, they looked around and all the other kingdoms, it was like you're in high school again, everybody else is a king, we want a king too. And God allowed them to have a king, and Saul was the first king of all of Israel. We then have the division of the nation. We have the fall of Israel to Assyria, King Shalmaneser. We have the fall of Judah by King Nebuchadnezzar. And then we have the return. And so a way you could look at this 1,000 years is really in five kind of categories. Conquest, monarchy, division, conquered, and returned. So in the book of Joshua, we read about conquest and the land, and most of the book deals with the battles. The monarchy begins in 1 Samuel. 1 Samuel was the first judge that was kind of a prophet and judge kind of mixed together. And he was the one that anointed Saul and anointed David, and I think anointed Solomon, though I may have that wrong. So Samuel, in the book of 1 Samuel, we have the work of the monarchy. All right, we're all right. All right, good. So, three kings then. We have the division of the kingdom. We have the two big battles between Assyria and Babylon. And then we have the return. And so these five words really summarize well the 1,000 years that we find in the historical books. Now, there's two other books of the 12 that really don't follow this timeline. Because there are two books that focus in on a single person in a single moment in their life. And that's the book of Ruth, who is a Moabite, and kind of her return to the land. And the book of Esther, who was the Jewish queen and rose to power at about the same time that the walls in the temple were being rebuilt back in Jerusalem. So if you take all these together, it's 1,000 years of history. From the Exodus, which happened in about 1450 BC, all the way up and through the rebuilding and reestablishing of worship in 516 BC and everything that happened between. So the bookends are kind of the Exodus. Remember, we talked about them leaving Egypt over there. The Exodus happened in about 1450 BC, 1,000 years of history until the temple is rebuilt and worship is reestablished in about 516 BC. So that's the history books, 12 books altogether. Well, maybe you say, well, Scott, how do you come up with those dates? How do you know that these things happen when you think that they happen? How do you know that the Exodus from Egypt happened in 1450 BC? How do you know that the temple was reestablished and worship was reestablished in 516. Well, how do you know these things? Well, we could spend a lot of time talking about the numbers that the Bible gives us, but throughout all of these history books, we are given specific numbers. Sometimes it's the number of people, like 50,000 people that leave Persia to return. The Bible says 50,000 actually gives us that number. But sometimes when it comes to dates, it's sometimes a little bit harder to figure out when these things happen. But the Bible is very specific. And when you put the Bible together with archaeology, you come up with some very amazing things. Let me show you just one. That's all we have time for today. So grab your Bibles and go to 1 Kings chapter 6. 1 Kings chapter 6. Now, 1 Kings chapter 6 is a pivotal moment in the history books. And it's pivotal because this is the chapter that describes the building of the temple. And we're going to come back to the temple in just a few minutes and we're going to talk about it. But this is the building of Solomon's temple. So three kings now: Saul, David, Solomon. Solomon's now the king, and one of the first things he wants to do is to build the temple of the Lord. But look what the Bible says. It says, in the 480th year after the people of Israel came out of the land of Egypt, in the fourth year of Solomon's reign over Israel, in the month of Ziv, which is the second month, he began to build the house of the Lord. The house that King Solomon built for the Lord was 60 cubits long, 20 cubits wide, and 30 cubits high. The vestibule in front of the nave was of the house was 20 cubits long, equal to the width of the house, and 10 cubits in front of the house. And he made for the house windows with recessed frames, and he built a structure against the wall of the house, running along the walls of the house, both the nave and the inner sanctuary. He made six chambers all around. The lowest story was 5 cubits broad. The middle was 6 cubits broad, and the third was 7 cubits broad. For around the house, outside of the house, he made offsets on the wall in order that the supporting beam should not be inserted into the walls of the house. All right, two things I want to show you. First thing, it says that in the 480th year after the people of Israel came out of the land of Egypt, Solomon began to build the temple. So what we do is we use archaeology to very specifically point to the exact date when Solomon began his rule. And we know that date. We then go 4 years forward, because it's the fourth year of Solomon's reign, and from archaeology, we know that was 967 BC. So then we go backwards 480 years, and we come to 1450, that the Bible says is the year that the Israelites left Egypt on the Exodus. Now, the rest of that story, I just read a little bit of it just to tell you how precise, when it comes to numbers, when it comes to structure, when it comes to instructions, when it comes to these things, the Bible is very precise. And so we don't have questions when it comes to a lot of these things. But my point is that the history that we find in these 12 books is history. It's precise. It's not fantasy. It's not a good, like, good night story for kids. It's not a nursery rhyme. This is history. And time after time, what happens with archaeology is archaeology comes along and it proves exactly what the Bible said is true. And so for a lot of years, for 1900, almost 2,000 years of church history, we had all of these names of people in the Bible that you know, scholars said, oh, these people never existed. Now, throughout the 20th century, then all these archaeological finds confirming time after time, people like King Shalmaneser and Sennacherib, confirming people like Pontius Pilate. It wasn't that long ago that people didn't think Pontius Pilate was really a guy until archaeology unearthed an arch that had the name Pontius Pilate on it. So archaeology comes along and proves time after time that what we find in the Bible is very, very true. So people like King Shalmaneser, places like Ramses and Goshen. Remember, when Israel went to Egypt, they lived in the land of Goshen. For a long time, nobody thought Goshen was a real place. Archaeology comes along and all of a sudden they discover, hey, you know what? This city used to be called Goshen, just like the Bible said. And even the changing of empires like Babylon. King Nebuchadnezzar was the king of Babylon. And in a few minutes, I'm going to show you the progression a little bit, but Babylon is conquered by the Medes and the Persians. First the Medes and then the Persians, and then they combine it all into one big empire. Well, for a long time, nobody thought that actually happened until archaeology came along, and lo and behold, exactly what the Bible said was true is exactly what archaeology found. And it's not just archaeology that proves this. Prophecy also raises our confidence that exactly what we find in the Bible and the history that we find in the Bible is exactly true. And in a couple of weeks, we're going to talk about prophecy. But let me walk you through a little bit of just how prophecy shows us that the history that we have in these 12 books is exactly true. So let me walk through a progression of prophecies and then show you their fulfillment in the history books. So here's the first one. Isaiah chapter 13. This is 175 years before it actually happened. Isaiah predicts, "I'm stirring up the Medes against them who have no regard for silver and do not delight in gold. And Babylon, the glory of the kingdoms, the splendor and the pomp of the Chaldeans, will be like Sodom and Gomorrah when God overthrew them." That's just part of the prophecy. Isaiah says that the Medes and the Persians are going to conquer the Babylonians. 175 years later, it happened. But it's not just true because I say it. It's true because the Bible says it's true. Let's go to the next one, Abby. So when did this happen? Daniel chapter 5. This is the handwriting on the wall, if you remember that story. That very night, after Daniel interprets the handwriting on the wall, King Belshazzar, the Chaldean king, was killed, and Darius the Mede received the kingdom, being about 62 years old. This is the fulfillment of Isaiah's prophecy 175 years before. But if we stop there, we don't get the whole part of the story. Because Jeremiah came along and he said, yeah, that's all great and true, but for 70 years, they're going to be in captivity. And so how is God going to get all of these Jews that are in captivity over there, how is he going to get them all the way back into this land? What kind of king is going to give up all of his workers and some of the best businessmen that he has? Who would do that? How is it? It's impossible. God can't really do that. And so Isaiah predicts 100 years before it actually happened, the actual name of the king would release the Jews. And here's what it says. This is Isaiah 44, who says of Cyrus, "He is my shepherd and he shall fulfill all my purpose," saying of Jerusalem, "You shall be built, and of the temple, your foundation shall be laid." This is 100 years before it happened. 100 years before it happened, nobody ever heard of Cyrus. Who is this Cyrus guy? 100 years later, Cyrus rises to power. He says to Nehemiah, the cupbearer, "Go, take all your people with you. Go rebuild the walls. I'm going to pay for it. Go rebuild your temple, reestablish worship. Take your people with you," exactly like Isaiah said. So here's the fulfillment of the prophecy in 2 Chronicles 36:22. It says, "Now in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, that the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah might be fulfilled, the Lord stirred up the spirit of Cyrus of Persia, so that he made a proclamation throughout all of his kingdom and put it in writing. Thus says Cyrus, king of Persia, the Lord, the God of heaven, has given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and he has charged me to build him a house at Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Whoever is among you of all of his people, may the Lord his God be with him. Let him go up." Now, this is shocking. Shocking. Because we can follow the progressions of prophecy 175 years before. We have Isaiah saying, "Hey, this is all going to happen." We have Jeremiah saying, "Hey, you know what? The Medes and the Persians, they're going to come along and they're going to conquer Babylon. And this guy, Cyrus, is going to come along and he's going to release everybody." And when Jeremiah said it, everybody was like, "That's never going to happen. What, you're crazy. What are you talking about?" And then it happens exactly like prophecy said. So what that does is it proves to us that the history that we have is true. And it raises our estimation of the history that we find in these books. And so the books of the history of the Bible here, these 12 books, what they do for us is they confirm that there is a direct relationship between the sovereignty of God and the happenings of current events. Let me say that again. There is a direct relationship between the sovereignty of God and the happenings of current events. Now, this is so important. And I want you to listen very closely. Because what is going on in our world right now is scary. And you can turn on the news, and it just all seems like it's bad news. And you can follow, you know, the big stories. You have mail bombers. You have border walls and the big caravan coming up from Central America. We have nuclear threats and sanctions on countries. We have reporters that are killed. We have corrupt people blaming other people for being corrupt. We have Fox News versus CNN. It almost seems like there's like a battle going on. You have the red wave and the blue wave on Tuesday, right? Will Republicans maintain the majority or not? Collusion with Russia. And you can just go through all of these stories. And if you watch those stories and you watch the news, there's a part of your heart that feels like the world is spinning out of control and nobody is in charge. And if there is somebody in charge, it sure doesn't feel like he's doing a very good job. And we grow afraid, I think. And we're afraid for our kids, our grandkids, and this world that they're inheriting. And then we listen to future predictions, you know, overpopulation. The ozone's going to be depleted. Nobody's going to be able to go outside. You have food shortages, predictions that by 2050, the world is going to have 9.5 billion people, and we're not going to grow enough food for everybody. You hear all of these things, and it can fill you with fear. And it can fill you with this, like, desire to, you know, become a hermit in Colorado mountain somewhere. Well, what the history books remind us is that no matter what the news says, there is somebody driving this ship. There is somebody that's in charge. There is somebody that's watching over all that is going on. Now, the word sovereignty simply means that God has kingly right over everything, that nothing happens outside of his kingly oversight. It means that God has no limits. A limited God is not God. Now, that's very important theologically for lots of different reasons. But a limited God is not God at all. So when we say that God is sovereign over all the world, it means that he is presiding over all these events, all that is going on, that he's never helpless, he's never despondent, he's never frustrated, he's never worried about all that is going to, that is all that is happening in the world. So listen, we then, as Christians, when we think about the sovereignty of God and his limitless reign and that he is our king, what it should do for us is it should give us this feeling of safety and security under the limitless reign of the great God of the universe. We know he keeps his promises. We know he can predict what's going to happen. But listen, I want you to understand, God does not predict what is going to happen. God knows what is going to happen. There's a difference. A prediction means kind of, I hope this is going to happen. God isn't predicting anything. He knows what's going to happen. So when it does happen, he doesn't go, huh, well, that was a lucky guess. He knows. He's sovereign. He oversees. Nothing happens outside of his knowledge. Nothing happens outside of his control. He is over it all. So listen, if you find yourself kind of as a fearful person, and you're afraid of the world that's spinning, or maybe if you are just struggling with fear right now, could it be that you are intellectually struggling with a God who is truly sovereign, that knows all, that sees all, that moves all events according to his will? Could it be that one of the reasons you struggle with anxiety is because you don't really think that God could really be over all of this, that he's not really in control, that he's taken too much of a hands-off approach? Or perhaps you resist acquiescing control of your life because you're not sure if you can trust that God. Because look what he did there. Look what he allowed there. How could a God who is in control and really love me let this thing happen? And this blindside event, does he not know? Does he not care? And you struggle a little bit, or maybe a lot of bit, with a limitless God who seems to be very hands off. Could it be, if I really pressed you, that you think that you would do a better job as God than he would? So listen, part of what happens, I think, in the history books is we just realize that no matter what it looks like on the outside, God is in control. He's driving the ship. He has the steering wheel in his hand. He knows where it's going. He's not worried. He's not fretting. He knows. And I think when you get to the point in your life when you can really surrender to his sovereignty and all that that means and all of the questions that come along with that, when you can do that, there is a wonderful sense of peace and security that becomes a part of your life. You surrender to his sovereignty, and that just fills you with a peace and security of all that you have in this king who is at the helm, has the steering wheel in his hand, and is in control of all things. And I'm not saying it's easy. There are thousands of things that happen that seem random or senseless. You can read about them in the paper. They're all over, and I understand those things. But I think believing in sovereignty is a little bit like believing in wind. Now, none of us have ever seen wind. We've seen the effects of wind, so we know it's there. But we've never seen wind. I think sovereignty is a little bit that way. We can see the effects of it, even though we can't see it sometimes in our own life. So we say that no matter what happens, no matter the good or the bad that comes into our life, God is sovereign. His will is manifest. I trust him no matter what it looks like on the outside, no matter the shell, no matter the hurt, no matter the surprise, no matter the blind side. I trust him that he is in control, and because I trust him, I can step back and have peace. And I think there are those among us that get to that point in their life, and it doesn't come quickly and it doesn't come easily. But it is a wonderful moment when you get there. So what we have in these books is, yes, we have history, and we have facts and numbers and dates and all those things, but really what we have is proof that God is sovereignly in control of all things. This is his world. And he even controls, according to these history books, the rise and the fall of governments. So no matter what happens on Tuesday or what happens 2 years from now, God is still in control. He was in control in 2016. He is always in control, even with the rise and the fall of governments. So listen, if he is at the helm, let him drive. He doesn't need a backseat driver. Let him drive the ship. Let him be in control. So what I want to try to do in the minutes I have left is I want to try to reduce 12 books in 1,000 years to one central event. A lot of people could say there are lots of great events and important events in here, but arguably the event around which all of the other events happen is really the temple of God. And so I want to walk you through the progression of how the Jews got their temple, lost their temple, got their temple, lost their temple, and lost their temple, and where we're at today. And I want to try to do that quickly and show you that progression. So I have a whole bunch of verses I'm going to show you. I'm going to try to fly through it. It all begins in Exodus 25. And in Exodus 25, this is part of the law that is given to Moses. And God says to him, "Let them make me a sanctuary that I may dwell in their midst. Exactly as I show you concerning the pattern of the tabernacle and all of its furniture, you shall make it." So this is when, if you remember the story, they're out in the desert. They're on top of Mount Sinai. God gives them the law. Part of that law says, "I want you guys to build me a sanctuary so that I can come and dwell in your midst." Now, the important part of this is that God says, "so that I can come and dwell in their midst." So then what happens in those verses following, it's a long story about how they constructed the tabernacle and all the gifts that people gave, and earrings and gold, and women were sewing various things, and there were all these workers that were doing the intricate work, and all that happened in that history. So for 15 chapters, we have the building of what we call the tabernacle. And that tabernacle then was completed. And in Exodus chapter 40, we have the kind of dedication service for the tabernacle. Now, what is important that you understand here is part of the dedication of that tabernacle was the moment when the glory of God descended down on the tabernacle and filled it up. We call this the Shekinah glory of God. Shekinah just means very presence. The very presence of God came down and filled the tabernacle. Specifically, it came down and resided over what is called the Ark of the Covenant. The Ark of the Covenant was a chest built by the Jews according to God's instructions. Inside that chest, Ten Commandments, a pot of manna, and the blossomed rod of Aaron. Those were put inside. Over the top was the cover was called the mercy seat. And there's all kinds of intricate details of that. But this was the Ark of the Covenant. So the Ark of the Covenant was the place where God's glory descended right there in the Holy of Holies in that tabernacle and filled it all up. So this is the first part of the story. So for 40 years of wandering then, the Israelites, what they did is they took this portable tabernacle from Mount Sinai. Remember the story, from Mount Sinai, they came to Kadesh Barnea. Abby, could you put that picture up? Kadesh Barnea. At Kadesh Barnea, remember they sent the spies into the land? Well, they had the tabernacle. And what the Bible says is that every time the cloud lifted from the tabernacle, everybody saw the cloud lift and thought, okay, it's time to go. And that's when they would pack it all up and pack up their belongings and they would move to a new place. My point is that God came down and he dwelled in the midst with the people, and the tabernacle, specifically the Ark of the Covenant in the Holy of Holies, represented for them, God is near, God is here. Well, after they cross the Jordan River back into the Promised Land, the years of conquest, Joshua, Judges, during the reign of Saul and during the reign of David, that same tabernacle that was built in Mount Sinai was still part of the portable kind of house of worship of God. It resided in Shiloh for a long time. And if you read 1 Samuel, you'll be introduced to a guy named Eli, who was the priest of God. This is the story of Samuel. Remember, Samuel was there ministering before the Lord, and he hears at night, Samuel, Samuel, and he thinks it's Eli, but it's not Eli. Well, the tabernacle at that point was in Shiloh. And during a lot of those years of the time of the judges and the first two kings, the tabernacle got moved to at least five different spots that we knew of. But it was a portable house of worship. That kind of, this is just a rendering of what it may have looked like. Well, then Solomon comes along, and Solomon builds the very first permanent structure that was designed to be the house of God. And he used the very same dimensions from the tabernacle. In fact, Abby, could you go back one? So God didn't tell Solomon exactly how to build the temple. What Solomon did is he took the dimensions and basic idea from the tabernacle to now build his temple using the same design. Again, this is a rendering. The bigger structure in the middle would be the Holy of Holies, or the most holy place where the Ark of the Covenant would have resided. On the day of the dedication, Solomon offered 22,000 bulls and 120,000 sheep in offering to the Lord. But the big moment was not the offerings and the day that the worker said, hey, it's all done, you know. The big day was when the Ark of the Covenant, which at that point was still not in the temple, it was brought to the temple with great celebration, great sacrifice, altars all over, lots of blood going, incense going. The Ark of the Covenant was placed inside the Holy of Holies. The people then stood on the outside and waited to see if the exact same thing would happen in the temple that happened at the tabernacle, if the glory of God, the Shekinah glory of God, would come down and rest upon that place. So they're all in the outside. they're singing, they're worshiping. And in that moment of the dedication, sure enough, the glory of God, this cloud came down right on the Holy of Holies and filled the temple with the presence of God. It was a great moment. So for the Jews, the tabernacle and then the temple, Solomon's temple, represented the very presence of God. So when Jeremiah came along and he predicted the destruction of the temple, everybody went, that's never going to happen. Who's going to kick God out, right? That's never going to happen. They didn't believe it was true. Ezekiel comes along and God gives him the vision to see a very important moment. And in that moment, what Ezekiel sees, he sees the cloud, the presence of God, moving off the tabernacle and ascending back into heaven. And just a few short years later, Nebuchadnezzar comes in and completely destroys the temple. Again, because of the sin of the people. 70 years go by, as we've talked about the story. The people of Israel, the people of Judah come back, and they rebuild another temple. This is called the Second Temple, or the Second Era Temple. And they rebuild the temple, but the new temple wasn't anything like the old one. The Solomon's Temple is sometimes called one of the seven ancient wonders of the world. Well, the new temple, they didn't have the money, they didn't have the gold, they didn't have the resources. So they built a temple, but it was nothing like this. And the people stood around, and remember I told you that a lot of the elders, they stood and they cried. And they cried because of the years that were lost, and they cried because of sin, and they cried because of the new temple. This new temple that was built was so kind of ratty compared to the old temple. But they really cried for another reason. Because on the dedication of that second temple, they all stood on the outside praising the Lord and singing, and they were waiting for the glory to come back down again. And as they waited and as they sang and as they prayed, the glory of God did not come down on that second temple. And all the people thought, God has abandoned us. He's no longer here. He's not going to come and bless us. He is not our God anymore. It was the prophet Haggai who was there and was with the people in this great moment of discouragement. And here's what he said to them. He said, "Who is left among you who saw this temple in its former glory? And how do you see it now? In comparison with it, is this not in your eyes as nothing? According to the word that I covenanted with you when I came out of Egypt, so my spirit remains among you. Do not be afraid." This is a pivotal moment in the entire Old Testament history, because the people of Israel always believed that the only way they knew the presence of God was with them is when the Holy of Holies was filled with His presence. They build now this second temple. There's no cloud, there's no Shekinah glory, and they thought God has left the building. Haggai comes along and says, "Don't you understand? Don't you realize? You can't confine the glory of God to a building or a box or a little Holy of Holies. Because the Spirit of God, God Himself, His presence, dwells with you. It's not that you have to go to the temple of Jerusalem to find Him. He dwells with you. And if He's with you every day, why be afraid?" So in a lot of ways, the people thought that God had abandoned them, that He no longer cared, and that maybe He wasn't sovereign at all. And Haggai says, "God's not confined to a little box. Just because you can't see me, I remain with you. And it may not look like it. It may not feel like it. And that old second temple might look a little ratty. But don't you forget that I am here. I'm close. I'm among you. I'm right beside you. And do not be afraid, because you are not alone." That's His message. That's a good message. Well, that second temple that they built in Jerusalem was destroyed in AD 70. So this would be after the time of Jesus, during the writing of much of the New Testament. The temple was destroyed again, and that temple has not been rebuilt. But here's what is so interesting. When we arrive at the New Testament, we find a whole different idea about the temple of God. And here's what Paul says. He says, "Do you not know that you are the temple of the Lord. That you're the temple of the Lord. That God's glory used to come down and dwell near the Ark of the Covenant, but now God makes his abode in you. God's glory used to dwell kind of over the mercy seat, but now he dwells inside you. God's glory used to be something you go to the temple to find, but now God makes you his temple. So that when you come to Christ, it's as if the very glory of God comes down and fills you up. So, Haggai is very right to say, he is close, he is near, do not be afraid. And the great advantage that we have as believers after Jesus is that God comes and fills us. You don't have to go to Israel to find the Lord. You don't have to go to a building to find the Lord. You, if you're a believer in Jesus Christ, you are the temple of God. And he promises that he will never, ever leave you. So how near is he? He lives inside of all true believers. So like Haggai says, you know, when you can't see his plan and you wonder if he's there, or if you wonder if he's really sovereign, or, you know, what is he doing all the time? Don't ever forget that the King of the universe, who is sovereign over all, dwells close to his people always.